Feast of Passover. This is one that you're probably familiar with, the Feast of Passover. Of the seven feasts, and I'm not sure whether the Jews keep all seven today or not, but of the seven feasts, this would be the one that probably not one Jewish family would skip. This one they will all do. Now, they may do some of the others also, but I know of this one probably they will perform the Passover in their home. It takes about 4 hours for them to go through the Passover feast. I have thought about going through that, but I don't think we have 4 hours to do that. I may explain some of the things to them that they do. But anyway, it will take more than one message for me to tell you about the puzzle parts and the meaning of the puzzle parts of the Passover feast. I want to begin the story, and you know a lot of this information already, but I think it's good background material. I want us to begin with the Egyptian holding Israel in bondage for about 400 years. Things for these Israelite people had grown steadily worse down through the years. And it's natural to assume that Israel would be a picture of the good guys who had done wrong, and Egypt would be a picture of the bad guys who were doing the wrong thing. All this story, I think, will make clear is that as we go into it, everybody in the story is a bad guy. Some just get their judgment quicker than the others do. For almost 400 years, the Israelites had been getting their judgment from oppression by the Egyptians. God was about to announce that, well, the time was coming when the Egyptians were going to get their oppression from God. So in a real sense, we have a picture that we have two bad guys, Israel and Egypt. And it would be wrong to assume that God owed Israel release from captivity by the Egyptians. That somehow they had been so good and done so many things to please God that God had to reward them by giving them relief from their oppressors. That is, they deserved God's help. And that's why God finally relinquished. That's not true. That's definitely not the case, although I think a lot of people would think that. The spiritual condition of the Israelites was little better than that of the Egyptians. A fact that I had not realized until I began to write this message. Thus, the Israelites and the Egyptians are both dwelling, in a real sense, in the land of bondage. Only one slight difference. The Egyptians are under the bondage of sin, of ignorance, and the devil. And the Israelites are under the bondage of sin, ignorance, and the devil, plus the Egyptians. So they had one slight difference as far as being in bondage. I want you to note some of the words that are later said in referring to Israel at this time when God decides to lead them out, which indicates that they were not good people. They were bad people. Actually, I guess they were almost as bad as the Egyptians. Not much difference in that. Now, if you say that to a Hebrew, he'd probably have a fit. But I won't tell you what you find in the Old Testament in explanation and description of the Israelites as God surveys them under Egyptian bondage. Leviticus chapter 17, verse 1. The Lord, now this takes us ahead in time of our story because we now have Moses in the picture, but and we already have the people delivered from Egypt, so we hadn't got there yet, but this is the period in which this Leviticus text comes. And the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron and to his sons and to all the children of Israel and say to them, this is the thing which the Lord commands. Look at verse 7. One of the commands. The people shall no more offer sacrifices unto devils. The implication is that at one time, under Egyptian control, the Israelites worshipped devils. The same devils the Egyptians worshipped. After whom they have gone a-whoring, this shall be a statute forever unto them throughout their generations. Give up the devils of Egypt, which they were worshiping. Look, if you will, at Joshua chapter 24, verse 14. Now, therefore, fear the Lord, and serve Him in sincerity and in truth. And those were He says to the people. Put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood when they were in Egypt. Again, put away the gods your forefathers served when they were in Egypt. They were idol worshippers. just as the Egyptians. Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 6 through 9. In that day that I lifted up my hand unto them to bring them forth out of the land of Egypt into a land that I had espressed for them, or searched out for them, or chosen for them, which flowed with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands, then I said to them, get rid of all the abominations from your eyes, and defile not yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. But they rebelled, and they would not hearken to me. And they did in every man cast away the abominations. They did not cast away the abominations of their eyes, neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt, still worshiping idols, the Egyptians worship. And I said to them, I will pour out my fury upon them because of my anger in the midst of the land of Egypt. So here we have three portions of Old Testament Scripture that clearly state there was a little bit of difference morally and spiritually between the Egyptians and the Israelites. They were both steeped in the same evil practices, probably in the same evil morality. So why did God owe them anything? He did not. He did not. Now we ought to be able to take just the few pieces of the puzzle that we have looked at so far to reach some conclusions. Number one, Egypt is a picture of the world in which you and I live, and everybody else. It's a picture of the world under the influence of idolatry, or under the influence of Satan, who is behind and imaged by all the idols. So in a sense, what you have here is a world under the influence of evil powers. That's what's pictured. Second, Satan is the mastermind behind the world system. It is his desire to enslave all people. Not just Israelites, but Egyptians were enslaved. They were enslaved to sin. As I mentioned, they were enslaved to ignorance. They were enslaved to his will and his power. Satan loves to enslave people, their minds and their hearts. That's his desire, to make them his servants. Now that's the world we all live in. He desires to force people to do his bidding, and do his plans, do his will. He does his best to force people to sin. And once he does, to hold them captives. Have you ever realized how hard it is to break a sinful habit? Climb up, straighten out, I'm going to make New Year's resolutions, and I'm going to change my life. You always know how hard that is? Because Satan feels like he has the right to control people. And he says, I'll tell you what you can do and what you can't do. Now, in 2 Timothy, chapter 2, verse 26, Paul talks about this strong power Satan has over people. 2 Timothy, chapter 2, verse 26. He says here that one might recover himself out of the snare of the devil. And here's the description of the devil. Who, these people, are taken captive by him at his will. Whenever he wants, he can send forth a temptation, break down a man's resistance, and cause them to indulge themselves in whatever activity he desires. Now, the Israelites were victimized by the devil, as were the Egyptians. Satan leaves nobody alone. Now, the people, Israelites, wanted freedom from their enslavement. They wanted to get out from under the misery and the pain and the hurt and the agony that was associated with their sin. I'm not sure they even saw themselves to be sinful people. They probably didn't see anything wrong with what they were doing. But anyway, all they wanted was relief. I find this is so typical of people in bondage. That's what they want. They pray that God give them relief. Not that God get them out of their sin. Not that God change their life. Not that God make them any different. Only get them out of the mess that sin has gotten them into. This is not how God viewed the situation with the children of Israel. He had a lot more in mind than just delivering them from their physical bondage and physical pain and misery. Isaiah chapter 42. Isaiah chapter 42, verse 5 through 7. Thus saith God the Lord, He that creates the heavens and stretches them out, He has stretched forth the earth, He that giveth breath unto the people upon the earth, and spirit to them that walk therein, I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness, and will hold thy hand. God is interested in what? Relief? No, He's interested in righteousness. I will hold thy hand, I will keep thee, and I will give thee for a covenant of this people, for a light to the Gentiles, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison. God is talking here about spiritual blindness and spiritual prison. And them that sit in darkness, I hope to bring out of the prison house. He's talking about spiritual bondage, moral deliverance. This is what he's talking about in the book of Isaiah. This is what he had in mind when he went to help the Israelites when they were in 400 years of Egyptian bondage. God is interested in man's total deliverance. It's a concept that most have a hard time accepting. They keep insisting that God only give them temporal assistance and mercy and help and relief. They don't want the total package. And this was, in a real sense, the case of the Israelites. Nothing has changed. Deliverance from the power of Satan and deliverance from sin is more important to God than deliverance from physical difficulties. So the Jews wanted one thing, freedom from Egyptian oppression. That's not all that God wanted to give them. Now, the point is also made here that those in bondage of sin can one day expect that that sin will bring affliction. Now, the Israelites were on the affliction of the Egyptians. The Egyptians were about to come on the affliction by God. Sin will eventually, at some point, bring about affliction. It will bring about pain. It will bring about sorrow. It will bring about tears. Eventually, that's going to happen. When? I don't know. But that's one of the things associated with sin, is affliction. There will come a time when sin will rob a man of his peace, of his happiness, of his joy, and very likely even his health. So we're born into a world like Egypt. We're born into a place where we're going to end up afflicted by sin and in bondage to the devil, where Satan is in control. Satan makes us victims of his whims and also victims of our own fleshly lust. And man can't get free. That's the point of being in prison and being in bondage, unless God, out of sheer mercy and grace, decides, I think I'll give you deliverance. Not because you deserve it, because I just so desire that you have that kind of relief. And God says, I want you to have, again, total relief. So, as you know, the day came when God went to a man called Moses, who was hiding out in the desert, who was an Israelite, and told Moses to go back to Egypt and to deliver the people from the hand of Pharaoh. To persuade the Pharaoh to let the people go, as you again recall, God sent plagues. Each one became more severe and more devastating. Now, the sentiment that Pharaoh takes towards these plagues and towards the command of Pharaoh to let the people go is typical of a person, I think, blinded by Satan. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1 through 2. Exodus 5, 1 through 2. Moses and Aaron went and told Pharaoh, the Lord says, let my people go, that they may hold a feast for me in the wilderness. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let the people go. Now, Moses had given command, and the response of the Pharaoh is the sentiment of people in the world. Number one, I have no interest in obeying your God. Number two, I don't want to hear about your God. I don't want to even learn about your God. I don't care about your God. Now, all Pharaoh wanted was for relief from what his sin was bringing upon him. That is, God was giving judgment. And Pharaoh said, would you get your God to bring me relief? Just lift the judgment. I don't care about your God. I don't care about your God's laws, but you just get that God, leave me alone. I'm sad to say, this is all the Israelites wanted God to do. Same thing. Just remove from our life that which is unpleasant, but leave everything else about us alone. Don't touch our idols. Don't touch our gods. Don't touch our religion. Don't touch our morality. I mean, you just get those Egyptians off our backs, but don't change anything in our lives. Make my sin painless. Let me do what you don't like and let me get away with it. That's basically what people say. That's when they run to God in prayer. Something happens to live in his sin. Oh, God, help me, help me, help me, help me. And so God says, okay, if I help, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to go back in my sin. But I'm not having a good time now because I don't feel good or I'm miserable. And just to take away the thing causing my misery, and I'll go back to doing the same thing. Will you be a different husband? Oh, I'm not going to be a different husband. Be a different wife? Oh, I'm not going to be a different wife. No, I'm not going to change anything. Just give me relief. In other words, we have people asking God to remove the sad side effects of our sin, but nothing more. Nothing more. There was no spiritual prayer request of the Israelites or the Pharaoh to make him obey God, to make him interested in learning about God. He didn't care. He just wanted God to do him a favor, to in a real sense, leave him alone. After the ninth plague, God tells Moses there'll be just one more. But it would be the most severe of all the plagues. Exodus chapter 11. And the Lord said to Moses, verse 1, I will bring one plague more upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards, he'll let you go. Now, he hadn't before. He says, this time he will. He'll not only let you go, he'll run you out. Verse 4. And Moses said, thus saith the Lord, about midnight, I will go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh that sits upon the throne, to the firstborn of the maidservant that's behind the mill, and all the firstborn of the beast. Now, this is the ultimate judgment that God places on sinners. On those who are bound by sin, who are under the oppression of the devil. By the way, as you look on in this story, you'll find that this was the only plague that was placed upon the Israelites, as well as the Egyptians. And all the other nine plagues, God spared the Israelites from any harm and any affliction that fell upon the Egyptians. Made them immune. Not this time. Under this plague, no one was spared, Egyptian or Israelite. And so the Israelites now are in just as much danger of this tenth plague as the Egyptians would be. In the Bible, death is spoken of as the king of terrors. Death is first mentioned to us by God when talking to Adam and Eve about not eating a knowledge tree of knowledge of good and evil, forbidden fruit. He said, eat thereof and you shall die. It's a shame that God did not explain to them what was involved in death. And we don't really know what's involved in death until we get to the New Testament. You don't learn about this in the Old Testament. But death is real. The Bible says that, old and new. Now, death does not free a person from life's earthly miseries. A lot of folks today are committing suicide. This is an easy way out. You don't go out anything. a great mistake here. Death is not the way out of misery. It's not the way to escape bondage. Actually, death, if you're not careful, can send you into a worse bondage than you ever knew on this earth. You'll be bound in a place of torment as the final judgment for sin. Nothing worse could happen than that. That is real bondage. Even the devil is going to be bound in this regard. And it's no joking matter. Not even to him. So he fears the day when he shall be bound in a place of torment himself, from which he can never escape, from which he will never find any relief. So death is a bad thing unless there is a way to get out of it. Now, let's look again at the pieces of the puzzle that we have thus far seen. From God's viewpoint, the Israelites needed a threefold deliverance. They only thought they needed one kind of deliverance. This is a mistake that lots of people, even today, still make. God has in mind three kinds of deliverance for Israel. First, they needed deliverance from the physical oppression of the Egyptians. Now, that's the one they wanted. That's the only one they had on their mind. God had two more kinds of deliverance that He wanted to give. Second, they needed deliverance from their own sinful practices, their idolatries, their sinful conduct and sinful ways. Thirdly, they needed deliverance from everything associated with death. Three kinds of deliverance God had in mind for the Israelites. They only wanted one. But as you go through these feasts, God begins to reveal the picture exactly what He wants to do for them. They wouldn't let Him. They didn't want the whole package. They just wanted part number one. Well, He gave them part number one. Part number two and part number three are more important than part number one. Now, one thing that always puzzled me about this tenth plague was it was only going to fall on the firstborn. That means Pharaoh must not have been firstborn because his son was going to die, but he wouldn't. It was a very selective plague. If you were secondborn, a thirdborn, a fourthborn, you got it made. But if you were firstborn, you're in real trouble. Now, I couldn't understand it because that's not what the Bible teaches. It says all have sinned, there are none righteous. So I can't say that we have here a picture of only one group of people in this world that has to worry about the bondage of death, and that being firstborn. That's the case. I got to worry about it. I'm a firstborn. And so I have looked at this, and I can't understand, because God is saying all people need deliverance from all the death tragedies and death experiences. Why do we just say the first part? That's inaccurate. So we'll say that. So I proceed to get on the phone, and I got a magazine from a person in California who's talking about Passover. So I said, well, this guy will know about Passover. I'll just call him and ask him. So he had an 800 number. I called up and I said, hey, explain to me this thing about the firstborn. And we talked a while, and this is the explanation he gave, and I have reworded it well, I can understand it better. But it makes sense to me. Well, the Passover feast never intends to teach that only firstborn people need to worry about death. That's just not true. What are firstborn? Firstborn are a true representative of all mankind. I say that, and I don't want to talk about it. All right? In a sense, we could say, though Adam was not born of a woman, in a sense, we could say that Adam would be a sample of a firstborn type of person. He's the firstborn sample, and we are all just firstborn copies of the original sample. You don't get somebody different in the firstborn than you get from mom and daddy. The same type. You still get a person just like mom and daddy. And so in God's eyes, in a real sense, when He says the firstborn, He's covered everybody. And then when you come to the New Testament, strangely enough, what do you have? God's saying, I can produce a secondborn type of person. He says in Nicodemus, what? You must be born again. You had the firstborn experience, your mom and dad. There's just one type. I can give you a second type of person. I can make you a secondborn. Now you're a firstborn. And the secondborn is pictured in the Feast of Pentecost. The firstborn face death. All of them do. None of the secondborn face death. And so when you come to Passover, God's going to tell them how you go from firstborn to secondborn. But they have never grasped this. They have never seen this. They don't understand this. And so I talked to this person up there in Florida, and that's the way he explained it. It makes sense to me. We're all firstborn. We're all like the first type. We're all just copies of Adam. We're a first. We're still a first. But then we can come along and get a second type of person, which is totally different than the first type. And that's the person who experiences the full package of deliverance that God wants to give to the captives of the devil. So I hope as we we'll go on, that as we look at the various other aspects of the puzzle of Passover, that you'll find this interesting and revealing as to where we are today in our lives.